Imagine you're on trial for your life, and you see the jury being selected based on race. That was the reality for Thomas Joe Millerell. In his case, it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. We're going deep on this one, folks. Millerell v. Drecke. It's a case that really shines a light on racial bias in our justice system.
Yeah, and you know, we have to remember that Batson v. Kentucky, that was already on the books, right? That already said you can't discriminate in jury selection based on race.
Yeah.
So Millerell really kind of pushes the envelope. It forces the courts to look beyond, you know, what's being said and really try to find these hidden patterns of bias.
So let's set the stage here. We're going back to 1985, Dallas, Texas quarter. Millerell is facing some serious charges, robbery and murder. And during jury selection, the prosecutors use what are called peremptory strikes. Basically, they can remove potential jurors without having to give a reason. And they use these strikes to eliminate 10 out of 11 black people who could have been on that jury. I mean, they got to raise some red flags, right?
Oh, absolutely. Millerell's lawyers, they called this out right away. They pointed right back to Batson v. Kentucky, which, as we said, forbids racial discrimination when you're picking a jury. But the trial court, they didn't see a problem. And Millerell, well, he was convicted and sentenced to death.
But the story doesn't end there. This case, it drags on for years, decades, even as it goes through the appeals process. What made this case such a long and difficult fight?
Well, this is where things get really interesting. The Supreme Court, they didn't just take the prosecutor's word for it. They really dug deep into the evidence, looking for patterns in the history of the Dallas County District Attorney's Office. And what they found was pretty disturbing. They basically uncovered five major areas of discrimination that pointed to bias.
Okay, so let's unpack these areas one by one. The first one, we have a huge statistical disparity. We're talking 91% of eligible black jurors were struck, compared to only 13% of non-black jurors. I mean, those numbers, they kind of speak for themselves.
Right, and it's not just about the numbers themselves. It's what those numbers tell us. The second area the Supreme Court looked at was comparative juror analysis. Basically, they compared the reasons jurors were removed and whether those reasons were applied consistently across the board.
So, like, if a black juror is rejected for saying they believe in rehabilitation, but then a white juror who says the same thing is allowed to stay on the jury.
Exactly. That kind of inconsistency is a huge warning sign. It suggests that the reason given wasn't the real reason. Then you've got the third area, which the Supreme Court called disparate questioning. Imagine potential jurors being grilled with these really graphic details about the death penalty, but only if they were black. That's what happened in this case.
It's almost like they were trying to scare them away. On top of that, you've got what's called jury shuffling. Prosecutors kept changing the order of the potential jurors, which essentially pushed black potential jurors further down the list, making it less likely they'd get picked.
Right. And then the final piece of the puzzle is the historical context. A training manual from the DA's office actually encouraged prosecutors to keep minorities off of juries. Talk about a smoking gun.
Wow. Each one of these things on its own is pretty troubling. But when you put them all together, it paints a really disturbing picture.
Yeah.
You know, I was especially struck by the comparison of two specific jurors. Billie Jean Fields, who was black and a white juror. Both of them expressed similar beliefs, but Fields was struck from the jury while the white juror was allowed to serve.
That's a perfect example of how comparative juror analysis can reveal hidden bias. It shows how these seemingly neutral reasons can actually be used in discriminatory ways. It makes you ask, you know, if the reason was truly neutral, why was it applied differently to these two people?
So with all this evidence of bias, it's not surprising that the Supreme Court ended up ruling in Millerell's favor, right? They basically said the Texas courts were being unreasonable by not acknowledging these clear signs of discrimination.
Yeah, that word unreasonable, that's really important here. It all goes back to a law called the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, AEDPA for short. And basically this law, it limits the power of federal courts to overturn decisions made by state courts.
So even though the Supreme Court saw all this evidence of racial discrimination, it wasn't just about being right or wrong. They had to prove that the Texas courts were so unreasonable that their decision just couldn't stand. Like, there's this higher bar for overturning a state court's decision.
Exactly. And this brings up these really interesting questions about the balance of power between state and federal courts and how the Supreme Court steps in to make sure justice is actually being served.
You know, it's easy to think that when the Supreme Court makes a ruling, everybody agrees. But that wasn't the case here, was it?
Not at all. This case was actually pretty controversial. Justice Thomas, he disagreed with the majority opinion.
What was his reasoning? I mean, the evidence seems pretty overwhelming.
Well, his main argument was that the Supreme Court was overstepping its bounds. He felt like they shouldn't have considered evidence that wasn't presented to the state courts initially. specifically that historical evidence about the training manual from the DA's office. He saw that as irrelevant to Miller L.'s specific trial.
So it's an argument about what evidence is admissible and how much weight should be given to past practices.
Precisely. And it really highlights this tension that can exist between federal and state courts, especially when we're talking about upholding constitutional rights in criminal cases. Justice Thomas also argued that the evidence didn't definitively prove racial bias. You know, he felt like the prosecution gave legitimate race-neutral reasons for striking those jurors.
He just disagreed with how the majority interpreted the evidence.
Yeah.
And felt the state court's decision should have been upheld.
Yeah, you could say that. The dissent basically argued that the majority's decision went against the principles of federalism and deference to state court decisions. They felt like the Supreme Court was kind of second-guessing the state court without a good enough reason.
It's interesting. Even in a case with what seemed like such clear-cut evidence, you still have these different interpretations of the law and how the evidence should be weighed.
Absolutely. And it really underscores the complexity of legal issues when you're dealing with race and the criminal justice system. You know, Miller L. v. Dredge, it's not just about jury selection. It's a bigger reminder of the systemic challenges we face in making sure everyone gets equal justice.
It makes you wonder, what are the lasting implications of Miller L. v. Dredge? It seems like it would have a significant impact on these Batson challenges and how courts assess claims of racial discrimination in jury selection.
Oh, it has had a huge impact. Miller L. really gave courts a clearer roadmap for evaluating these claims of racial discrimination. It emphasized looking at the whole picture, you know, including things like statistical disparities, side-by-side comparisons of jurors, and even historical evidence of discrimination.
So it's not just taking the prosecutor's word for it. It's about really scrutinizing those supposedly race-neutral explanations for striking jurors.
Exactly. Miller L. basically said, we're not just going to accept these explanations at face value. We're going to dig deeper and see if those reasons actually hold up under scrutiny.
This case seems like required reading for any lawyer, especially those working in criminal law. What are the practical takeaways for them?
Well, for one, it highlights the importance of really meticulous documentation during jury selection. Lawyers need to carefully record the reasons for strikes, both for their own client's case and for any potential Batson challenges that might come up later.
Like you're building a record that can be examined later on. If a Batson challenge does come up, you have the evidence to back up your arguments.
Precisely. And beyond documentation, Miller L. shows how crucial comparative analysis is. Lawyers need to be prepared to compare the characteristics and responses of jurors who were struck versus those who were allowed to serve.
It sounds like a lot of work, but it's clearly essential to ensure a fair and impartial jury.
That's the key takeaway here, Miller L., is a reminder that even when we have laws in place to prevent discrimination, those laws are only as good as the people who enforce them. And that enforcement requires vigilance, awareness, and a real commitment to fighting bias wherever it shows up.
Speaking of fighting bias, I found Justice Breyer's concurring opinion in Miller L. particularly interesting. He actually suggested that we might need to rethink the entire peremptory challenge system.
That's right. He expressed serious concerns about how easily peremptory challenges can be misused, especially for discriminatory purposes. He even suggested that maybe it's time to get rid of them altogether. You know, he acknowledged the history and importance of peremptory challenges, but he questioned whether they could truly be reconciled with the constitutional guarantee of equal protection.
That's a pretty bold statement coming from a Supreme Court justice.
It is. While the majority didn't go quite that far, Breyer's concurrence shows that this debate about peremptory challenges is definitely not over.
It raises some tough questions about the future of jury selection and how we can best guarantee fairness and impartiality in our courts.
This case really highlights the ongoing struggle to eliminate racial bias from our legal system. It reminds us that we can't afford to be complacent. The fight for equal justice requires constant vigilance and a willingness to challenge the status quo.
You know, Justice Souter put it really powerfully when he wrote, "It blinks reality to deny the state struck jurors because they were black." It's a harsh truth, but it's a truth that resonates far beyond this case. And remember, this was a capital murder case. We're talking about life and death here.
That's a crucial point. Miller L. wasn't just about some abstract legal arguments. It was about a man's life and the very real possibility that racial bias could taint the foundation of our legal system.
So it really makes you think, can a system like this with peremptory challenges, where you don't have to give a reason, can it ever be truly fair?
I mean, that's the million-dollar question. And there are definitely good arguments on both sides. You know, people who support peremptory challenges, they'll say they're crucial for getting impartial juries. They allow both sides to remove jurors who they think might be biased, even if they can't point to a specific reason why.
But as we saw in Miller L., You know, not having to give a reason that can open the door to implicit bias, even if it's not intentional.
That's exactly right. That's the heart of the problem. You know, critics of the system, they say peremptory challenges are just too easy to manipulate, especially when it comes to race. They argue that the risk of, you know, perpetuating the systemic bias in our courts, it outweighs any possible benefits.
So then what are the solutions? How do we move forward?
Well, there are a lot of different reform ideas being tossed around, everything from like stricter limits on peremptory challenges to just getting rid of them completely. Some people think there should be a higher burden of proof when you're trying to justify a strike. You know, others say we should just limit the number of strikes each side gets.
It sounds like finding a solution that balances the need for fairness with, you know, the practical side of jury selection. That's a tough balancing act.
It really is. And it's a challenge that we have to face head on as a society if we truly care about equal justice for everyone. We need to be having these open and honest conversations about the possibility of bias in our legal system. And we have to be willing to explore real reforms.
Miller L. V. Dreca. It's a case that continues to be so relevant even today. It really forces us to confront some hard truths about our justice system. And it inspires us to keep pushing for a fairer and more equitable future for everyone.
Yeah, it's a powerful reminder that the fight for justice, it's not a one-time thing. It's an ongoing process that requires our attention and our action. We can't just sit back and be passive observers. We have to actively participate in creating a justice system that truly lives up to its name.
Well said. That was a deep dive into Miller L. V. Dreca. It's been eye-opening and definitely thought-provoking. It's clear that this case has had a major impact on the legal world and the fight for racial justice, and it serves as a powerful reminder of all the work that still needs to be done to make sure we have a truly fair and impartial justice system for everyone.